The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm pleased to be here. A Yale University professor of law, history, and African American studies, Elizabeth Hinton is one of the country's foremost experts on policing, racial inequality, and criminalization. She is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime: The Making of Mass Incarceration in America, and her articles and essays have been published in The Atlantic, The Nation, and Time, among many other places. A New York Times review of her new book, America on Fire, calls it groundbreaking, deeply researched, and profoundly heartrending. The book reveals the deep roots of the current movement to reject a system of law enforcement that defines as the problem the very people who continue to seek to liberate themselves from racial oppression. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Jill Lepore. Dr. Lepore is the David Woods Kemper Professor of American History and Law at Harvard University. She is also a staff writer at The New Yorker, and her many books include These Truths, A History of the United States, named one of Time Magazine's top 10 nonfiction books of the decade. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Hey, great. Thanks so much, everybody. It's great to be here. Laura, thanks so much for hosting these events. I can't say how much I admire everything that you do and what the Free Library of Philadelphia stands for, and how ardently I, and I'm sure Elizabeth as well, wish that we were in your beautiful building in a hall with all of you, a little sweaty maybe coming in on the hot early spring evening. It's really hot where I am, but kind of gathered together and sharing some air and the mumbling and murmuring of a space together, and that sort of special vital energy that we could have together. I just kind of wanted to take a moment to pause and conjure that for all of us. I've been watching videos lately of concerts in Central Park and imagining we get to do these things again together soon. But even in this strange Zoom format, it's just an incredible honor to have the chance to speak with Elizabeth Hinton, who is one of the nation's most important historians. I urge you both to read her new book, America on Fire, that we'll be talking about today. You can find a link to purchase the book in the chat of this conversation this evening, but also her really groundbreaking first book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, which really changed the nature of a public conversation as well as a scholarly conversation among historians. And it's not a lot of books that have that kind of reach, that have the serious archival and empirical work that Professor Hinton brings to everything that she does, and also just the kind of clarity, the moral clarity, the intellectual clarity of speaking to a much bigger audience about essential questions of our day and casting them in historical light for all sorts of readers. So Elizabeth, it's great to be here with you, and I'm excited to talk about this book, which I noticed the historian Eric Boner said could not possibly be more timely. And indeed that is the case. One wishes, I think, that it were less. So, but one of the things I really want to talk to you about is that the nature of these patterns, these historical patterns. But what I want to begin with, you know, knowing that a lot of the people who are joining us here this evening haven't had a chance to read the book yet, I actually wanted to begin by asking you to think about a particular story. I mean, every incidence of racial violence is different, and I don't mean to be reductive here, but I wanted to invite you to tell us a story about a particular time and place, a moment that illustrates what you call the cycle of violence, thinking from the 1960s and 1970s, which your book is primarily about, all the way down to the present.
Well, first, I just want to thank you, Jill, for that incredibly all too generous introduction, and also for your time. The honor to engage in this dialogue with you about this work is all mine. And then, of course, Laura and the Free Library for hosting this event, all of you for being here. I too wish that we could be in person, but these conversations, especially in this moment, are so important. And so I'm glad that we'll have an opportunity to engage. So there are many, many stories that are kind of near and dear to me in the book. I guess one that is a thread throughout is the story of Caro, Illinois. And that the story of Caro really kind of stuck out to me and felt like something that hadn't really been recognized and that needed to be told. For me, when I learned about the history of Caro, it really haunted me, because on the one hand, the violence in Caro was particularly exceptional, but it also is kind of a warning about the kind of the end game or what can potentially happen if we allow racism to guide our policies and white supremacy to steer the way in which we allocate resources and think about rights. So Caro, you know, one of the kind of central premises of the book is the way in which police violence itself sets off a kind of cycle of community responses to that violence. And so there's the literal in these moments of political violence, the way in which police violence sets off community responses. So, you know, a group of officers who arrests a group of, you know, a kid or a group of kids for hanging out in the park after dark. And the kids, you know, see this arrest itself as something violent and may respond by throwing rocks and bottles. The officer calls for backup. And then the violence can escalate from there, taking on a variety of forms. So there's that literal cycle within the rebellion. And then there's the policy cycle, where the response to this community violence is always more policing. In Caro, the kind of cycle of rebellion and police violence, but also white supremacist terror, was particularly protracted because of the political and economic power structure in the city. And Caro is a small town in the mid to late 1960s. There were about 4,000 residents there. It's at the southernmost tip of Illinois, at the convergence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. In some ways, it's actually below the Mason-Dixon line. Looks very much like a southern city. And Black residents there were just under the majority and locked out of political and economic power accordingly. This is also a moment beginning in the 1960s, where we begin to see a white establishment embracing vigilante violence and a politics of white supremacy that is different from the kind of Klan violence that had characterized so much of the white supremacist terror throughout the 20th century. This is a kind of post Brown v. Board phenomenon that is very much in response to the kind of the gains of the civil rights movement. In Caro, activists for years had used nonviolent channels to desegregate public institutions, to demand political and economic power. It was a site where the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and John Lewis came in the early 1960s to desegregate public institutions. And none of these efforts had worked to secure basic rights for Black people. And by the late 1960s, the white vigilante mobs that had formed there in kind of cahoots with law enforcement authorities and political economic elites essentially unleashed terror on the Black community. Beginning, you know, in March 1969, a group of white men stood on the Mississippi levee and began to shoot into the Pyramid Courts housing project that was segregated and entirely Black. So that, you know, for years, the children who grew up in this housing project slept in bathtubs out of fear that they were susceptible to getting shot by this vigilante mob. And the Black residents in Caro had absolutely no protection against this violence because the power structure, the vigilante organization called the White Hats took on a variety of forms, but known popularly as the White Hats, was deeply, deeply embedded in the county and local law enforcement. And so in response, the Black residents in Cairo armed themselves in self-defense and continued their nonviolent campaign. They launched a boycott that lasted for several years of all the white owned stores in the district, essentially saying, we're not going to patronize these business owners so that they can go and buy bullets to then later shoot at us. And you know, this went on for years. Of course, the newspapers reported it. You know, the dominant kind of media narrative about this is that these armed militant Black men were indiscriminately shooting at white residents in Cairo. This is how the story was portrayed to most of the to much of the nation. Much of the news coverage kind of took that stance. But you know, the lesson here is that rather than actually concede to Black residents' demands, the political and economic elites of Cairo allowed the stores to close. They refused to give political and economic rights and resources to the Black community in Cairo, who suffered from extreme rates, some of the highest rates of poverty in the state, and who basically had only access to dilapidated shack housing or deteriorating housing projects. And so rather than, you know, concede these rights, concede these resources and basic human needs, the political and economic elite there just allowed the city to die. They allowed the economy to tank. They allowed the businesses to close. Their children, if they could, left. And this is where, you know, this is a real kind of warning for us about the dangers of, again, holding on to these racist white supremacist views, that this is, that racism is a disease that in the end will harm all of us, and that we will all be better off if we work to foster a more inclusive society, and that the kind of entanglement between law enforcement and political and economic elites is a particularly deadly combination that we see playing out in various forms again and again. But for me, Cairo was just this metaphor that, again, you know, these stories of like German shepherds being unleashed on young Black children in the city as they were walking home from school into the 70s, for me was even surprising, just in terms of, you know, like the extent to which this kind of racism was still very much alive and structured social relations in the years after the civil rights movement.
Yeah, that's such a, it's such a powerful and distressing story. And the way you, to hear you talk about it now reminds me a lot of Heather McGee's argument in The Sum of Us, the kind of drained swimming pool theory that right. Whites will again and again give up all kinds of public goods for the sake of denying them to other people. Which Cairo is just a really distressing version of that story, but there's also a lot more going on there. And I want to think a little bit about, I got lost in the timeline that's the appendix to the book, which I don't think all readers would get lost yeah. in, which is this really staggering list, you know, year by year, town and city by town and city, that you compiled working with Kerner Commission records, the records of the Lemberg Center, and the work of Christian Davenport. And so I wanted you actually so having now looked at this one place in a particular moment in time, sort of one of the things I hear you saying about the story that you've just told is how it changed your notion of a timeline, right? That these rebellions don't end in 1968, they go into the 1970s. We need to think differently about the timeline. But I kind of wanted to ask you to tell me a little bit literally about the timeline, that is to say about the body of evidence that you compiled here, you know, with collaborating with people like Christian Davenport on that timeline, because reading the book, it's just relentless. It does not stop. It just keeps happening again and again and again and again and again. And I'd love to hear what that was like for you as a researcher, as you put that together and as you laid that all out and thought about, you know, how am I going to communicate the ubiquity and the ceaselessness of this cycle?
So I love that question. And I thought, Jill, of like, if anybody, you know, like I knew that you would.
I'm going to nerd out on your opinion.
And I will say too, I am deeply grateful to Jill because Jill read a Word version of the manuscript without the timeline included. So this is a post-edition. And it's actually one of the things that I am the most proud of in the book. And for me, it gave me an opportunity to kind of lay out all my data. To actually prove that these incidents were widespread and to disrupt these kind of conventional historical narratives that we have. For me, the timeline is a gift for future historians. I think it opens up all kinds of new questions, but it also shows us that we all have a stake, that this history impacts all of us and that we all have a stake in this, that, you know, that what happened to George Floyd and Derek Chauvin's trial was not, relegated to Minneapolis, that it's part of a national story. And I would bet that many of us, if not all of us, can find our hometowns or a place that we've lived or passed through or lived near in the timeline. So it is a 25-page compilation of all of the cities, according to the archives that I use, that experienced some form of rebellion. And my archival source base for the first part of the book, which really looks at what I call the crucible years of rebellion from 1968 to 1972, is based on the Lemberg Center for the Study of Violence records. And the Lemberg Center formed shortly after John F. Kennedy's assassination, and sought to document and track conflict in American society and violence, and not just the rebellions in US cities, but also anti-war protests, student movements, labor disputes. And this archive had, for the most part, been closed to the public for decades and had been kind of like passed around among a group of political science professors. It contains, you know, quantitative analysis of the violence, oral history, interviews, reports. But what I used were the newspaper clippings. Essentially the Lemberg researchers had access to all of these local news sources and just pulled these clippings and wrote little reports summarizing all of these incidents of violence. And so when I walked in, you know, I met Christian Davenport in 2016, shortly after I finished my first book. We started talking about rebellion in general. He was getting ready to do a 50-year retrospective on the Detroit Rebellion of 67. And he said, you know, come to my office. And, you know, it was very generous because a lot of scholars don't do that. He said, sure, come take a look. He was doing the quantitative side of this. And when I went to his office, again, this is a very different archival experience because it's in a more private place. It was just boxes and boxes and boxes and stories and stories and stories of this history that I had a sense of, that I had a sense that I thought might have happened when I wrote my first book, but there was no way to actually capture it. And it just opened up all kinds of new questions for me. And it especially showed, or it reinforced the impact of federal crime control policy and the way that communities responded to the expansion of policing and the militarization of police forces and targeted low-income communities of color after the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act passed, which is the first major piece of federal law enforcement legislation in 68. The narrative that I had, that many of us had, and I even, you know, advanced it in my first book, is that, you know, the era of rebellion begins in Harlem in 1964. And then, you know, there's this unprecedented violence during the rebellions in Newark and Detroit in the summer of 67. And then the kind of last hurrah are the 100 or so incidents that follow the assassination of Martin Luther King in April 1968. But what what the timeline shows and what the Lemberg archive reveals is that actually the peak years of rebellion were after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination and followed the enactment of the Safe Streets Act from 1968 through the early 70s. There were about, I think, 350 incidents from 64 to Martin Luther, including Martin Luther King in April 68. And from May 68 through 1972, there were by my count, according to the Lemberg Archive, about 1,950 incidents in a little under 1,000 cities. And so this is really important because it shows how, you know, the earlier experimental programs of the war on crime, which Johnson had declared in 1965, as they began to hit smaller cities like Cairo, like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, like Carver Ranches, Florida, like Albuquerque, New Mexico, smaller cities across the United States, rural communities, mid-sized cities, that were not the initial recipients of the grants earlier in the decade. Once these smaller police forces expanded, militarized, residents responded in much the same way as their counterparts in the larger cities. And this is why the timeline is so key, because it makes that very clear. It's an argument that I make in the book, but the timeline itself really gives an entirely new sense of the way in which Black people in particular in targeted communities responded to the policing of everyday ordinary activity. And that, you know, this was again a national phenomenon. The idea is that, you know, so-called rioting was a Northeastern, you know, occurred mainly in the Northeast. And this shows too, that, you know, in the Southern states, which are often seen as like, you know, being part of a kind of nonviolent movement exclusively, that rebellion occurred very frequently, and that it also occurred in the West and the Sun Belt and in New England, that it was a national phenomenon and that there are certain patterns that we can glean from it. So in that sense, you know, I think the book, but the timeline especially, really opens up new questions about Black protests and really opens up, again, new questions about the policy responses to that protest and the continued embrace of police and surveillance and later incarceration as a solution.
Yeah, no, it's really essential. And I had, you know, 1,000 more questions about the timeline, but I want to just ask one, because I don't, not everybody's going to be as obsessed with it as I am, but it made me think a little bit about, you know, many years ago, I wrote a book about an alleged conspiracy of enslaved people in New York City to burn the city down in 1741. And analytically, it seemed really important to me to say, do you know what we could think about this population of enslaved people as? We could think about it as a political party. Because we think about New York in the 1730s and 1740s as having been the origins of the tolerance for a party system, which is this whole other unrelated thing. But like, just and I kind of tried to put that out there, like we could think about this group of people as a political party in the classic political science sense. They have a shared set of political objectives. They're acting together. They have leaders who represent their views. Like, why can't we think about these people who are enslaved? Okay, they're disenfranchised, but why can't we think about them analytically as a political party? Because it would help us take seriously right. what they're doing as a politics, mm-hmm. right? And I thought about that. Somehow this argument didn't really stick. Like, I didn't really transform that discussion. But I thought about that here because one of the things you insist on at the very beginning of the book and then throughout, and I think you make this case very persuasively, is that it's a huge disservice to our understanding, certainly in the moment, to the public's understanding, the larger public's understanding of what was going on. But it's a huge disservice to our historical understanding of this political moment to not think about this as a politics. So to say these are riots and this is a kind of criminal activity is to misunderstand the nature of these actions, that you are taking them like out of the box that says crime and putting them into the box that says politics. And the one way you do that is to say, we don't call these things riots, it's a misnomer, right? And that we want to look at riots, we can look at white riots. Mm-hmm. We're going to call them rebellions. And then you have this body of evidence that shows the pattern that this is a national political movement. But what then is the political argument of the rebellion? If we think about this era and think about these actions in many different places that we can now, because of your work, you know, look, and because of the work of the Lemberg Center, really look at across the timeline, what is the political argument of this form of political expression?
Yeah, and that's why too, I think, you know, the patterns, I mean, every rebellion was distinct, of course, and has a distinct set of actors and causes, but there are these clear patterns, and there are these very well articulated demands that often emerge out of them. So, you know, I think one of the things that's really important to understand, and this was, you know, true in 1964 as it was in 1972, although there are important shifts within kind of the mainstream civil rights movement occurring between those 2 years. And that is that, you know, the grievances behind Harlem, Watts, Cairo, Newark are all rooted in the same fundamental demands and grievances of the civil rights movement, right? The civil rights movement was about an end to police brutality, protection against white supremacist terrorism, access to jobs, educational opportunities, decent housing, essentially full political and economic inclusion in American society. These are the same grievances and demands that lead communities to erupt as a reaction to an incident of or as a reaction to a police encounter, very often police violence. I think one of the things that is really important here too, and again, back to the timeline and why that like peak period of 68 and 72 is so important, is that, you know, many of the young people who participated in this form of political violence had kind of come of age or come into older teenagehood or adulthood watching the civil rights movement unfold and seeing many of those promises not be fulfilled even through nonviolent direct action channels. Similar thing, you know, we see in Cairo where, you know, throughout the decade of the 60s, the Black residents there had used the conventional tactics of the mainstream civil rights movement. And by the end of the decade, this had failed to protect them from the police officers arbitrarily arresting them and the white vigilante mob shooting into the housing project. So we see this shift, I think, especially encapsulated by Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, where especially among young Black people, the thrust of civil rights protests shifts from nonviolent direct action to these ideas of self-defense. And increasingly, you know, the response to the expansion of policing and the strategies of the war on crime that promoted the policing of everyday ordinary activity under the idea that the best way to stop crime was not to stop it when it actually occurred, but to identify people who might commit crime. This is a legislative category that emerges in the 1960s, you know, potential delinquents, potential criminals that officers were charged with finding and apprehending. And so, you know, the community responses to that, especially when these officers are now carrying surplus weapons from Vietnam, like M4 carbine rifles and M16s and bulletproof vests and riot control helmets and 3-foot baton sticks and all of these new technologies that that police departments have, due in large part to the new federal grant funding, really changes the kind of terrain of protest. And the demands that emerge out of these moments of political violence, where, you know, many civil rights leaders in the community and in Black churches, just like that had steered the mainstream civil rights movement, take the violence as an opportunity to continue to wage sets of demands on municipal authorities, again attempting to advance the same goals that that had steered the freedom movement historically. So in many ways, this, you know, I see this as a kind of next chapter of the movement, a continuation of the struggle that we're still very much living in the aftershocks of, but yet we still haven't fully appreciated. And doing so, you know, recognizing this also forces us to confront some of the shortcomings of the civil rights movement and the progressive reforms of the 60s.
So how do you take us, I know that people who are watching are going to have a lot of questions about where we are now. So before we go to questions from people in the audience. I want to ask you to help us get from that 1972 marker of time to 1991 and Rodney King and down to 2020. And I mean, there's a certain amount of leapfrogging.
Yeah.
And the book does a certain amount of leapfrogging.
Yes, yeah.
Because we're all, everything you're reading about 60 to 72, you're just thinking about how come this didn't end then? Because I think the question is just like every page of this book, like how come this didn't, like why wasn't, how are we still? But a really, to me, fascinating distinction that you drew between this, the era that we're talking about, the sort of long 1960s, and today, is you remarked that in 2020, instead of attacking police cars and police stations, although there was some of that, that a lot of protesters attacked monuments. And I was fascinated by that as a fairly signal difference between these two moments. And I wonder if you could help us to understand why that would be. What is it about history? And even, in fact, this history, this is kind of like a meta question. Like there's a kind of meta quality to Black Lives Matter. It's not just about Black Lives Matter and now, it's about all the ways in which this struggle has been fought and fought and fought and fought and fought, right? Like our great grandfathers fought this struggle. I think, you know, you hear people say in very poignant way, you know, my grandmother tucked kids into the bathtub. Why am I tucking kids into a bathtub, right? Like, so that sense, and partly this is why there's something even meta for me about the timeline, right? Which asks us to put ourselves on a timeline. Like, why in 2021 are we here? Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Like, what, where are we in time? So I'm sorry, I threw a lot of different things at you, but I guess I'm wondering if, you know, how you get across that river, right? From 72 to 91. As a historian, and how do we get to 2021?
Okay, I'm going to try my best to do this gracefully, but bear with me, everyone. So, you know, rebellion continues through the 70s, but at a much less frequent pace. And part of, you know, the end point in 72 is that the Lemberg Center closes in 73. And so, you know, hopefully, again, this work will open up new questions. I mean, there are reported incidents of rock throwing and continued clashes between police and communities. But we know that by 72, the levels begin to resemble what they did in 64 and then fizzle out. I think part of this, you know, the kind of decline of rebellion in the 70s has to do with advances, very important advances in terms of Black political representation. Of course, the Congressional Black Caucus forms in 1971. Many of the young people who couldn't vote, you know, in the 1960s and due in large part to the voting drives of the civil rights movement, you know, mobilized to elect Black officials at all levels of government, leading to a kind of representation that hadn't been enjoyed since Reconstruction. And I think that had a direct impact on the kind of frequency of this kind of violence, because people in many cities who were previously excluded or prevented from any kind of political and economic representation were beginning to see themselves on city councils and in city hall. And I think this makes an important difference. Also, of course, you know, during this period, this is when you begin to see the rise of mass incarceration. And by the mid-1970s, the transformation of the US prison system from being majority white to majority Black and brown for the first time in US history. So a number of the young people who might have participated in these rebellions were getting locked up under increasingly long terms. And the, you know, the big question is this, that, you know, this collective violence that was once expressed against external forces, against police and repressive institutions, increasingly turns internal in the form of gang violence and community warfare beginning in this period as well. So there's a lot going on in that sense. It also kind of indicates that, you know, perhaps residents and communities that were being policed in new ways under the banner of the war on crime had accepted the kind of policing, you know, the breaking up of house parties, the arrests of groups of teens, you know, just hanging out, the kind of police, the everyday police brutality or police aggressions that that had once kind of sparked community outrage just became bitterly accepted. And so by, you know, Miami in 1988 and Los Angeles in 1992 and beyond, you no longer see eruptions in response to the kind of, again, what I've been saying again, the policing of everyday life. You see them in response to exceptional incidents of police violence or miscarriages of justice. So both Miami in 1980 and LA in 1982 are not about actual incidents of police brutality. In Miami, a group of police officers savagely beat a Black motorist to death and then attempted to cover it up. And then 92, four officers beat Rodney King in a videotaped incident of brutality, which is kind of like the first viral video of police violence, right? But it wasn't those incidents that set off the rebellions themselves. It was the acquittal. It was the lack of accountability for the officers in both cities that led to particularly violent eruptions. I mean, Los Angeles was the property destruction and the arrest tally in Los Angeles remains unprecedented. One of the things that is interesting about the kind of uprisings or the violence that we've seen in response to mainly police killings from, you know, during Obama's second term from Michael Brown and Ferguson onwards, is that they all started in response. They all started nonviolently. You know, they all started at nonviolent protests or peaceful vigils when police responded to those protests with tear gas. And beating people with their batons and making mass arrests, again, setting off this cycle of police violence and community violence, where some of the protesters then responded with violence and responded by setting buildings on fires and responded by looting. But this indicates that, you know, that the protests themselves, people who are demonstrating for racial justice and against police brutality, have gotten increasingly less violent than their counterparts in the 60s and 70s, and even in LA 1992, in Cincinnati, Ohio in 2001, and yet levels of police violence have maintained themselves. And I think that that helps us to understand the kind of emphasis last summer on defacing or removing or attempting to destroy monuments to white supremacy, especially, you know, celebrating Confederate soldiers, but also conquistadors and figures who are celebrated for brutality, murder, genocide, and a white supremacist politics. And I think part of this has to do with a kind of new scripts of resistance, and a different kind of awareness and reckoning with history that in many ways is the product of the, you know, one of the major achievements of the civil rights movement. And that is, of course, the expansion of college and university education to students of color, and the, you know, where I am, right, African-American studies departments and new scholarship and new scholars who have exposed this history so that we know, you know, more about it. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things about Black Lives Matter is that it really, you know, synthesizes both the kind of the strains of the freedom struggle, right? I mean, in embracing the nonviolent tactics of that are associated with Martin Luther King, kind of the mainstream civil rights movement in the 60s, with a kind of militancy and structural analysis that is often, although unfairly, associated with the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement. And I think that kind of language, that understanding, and the new kind of reckoning and understanding of systemic racism in general and the history of racial oppression and exploitation in this country has, you know, helped to shift the focus to these monuments, these symbols of white supremacy as a powerful way to protest for racial justice and to see immediate results and to reclaim. I mean, you know, one of the things that was just really remarkable about what we saw at the monuments last summer is that people made them into murals. Like in Richmond, people painted, you know, pictures of George Floyd on the statues of Confederate soldiers. And so in this moment of like national mourning, national reckoning, it was also about reclaiming in a way that didn't cause harm, direct harm to an individual person.
I want to encourage everybody to use the Q&A function to raise questions. And I, sadly, we would love to pull up your faces and see them and hear from you, but that's not how Zoom works in this webinar. So I'll be reading some questions. And I have a question that follows up from what you just said, which I think was just incredibly helpful in thinking about the different streams of political style that contribute to Black Lives Matter, that it's drawing on the nonviolent tradition of civil rights, but also on some of the structural analysis of, you know, the Black Power movement, but then it also has this kind of African-American studies element to it with regard to kind of moral reckoning, which I think also, I would say, comes out of the American Indian movement or the Columbus 500th anniversary in 1992, which generated a lot of attention to monuments and instruction, right? You know, even just thinking to the 60s and the demands for Mexican-American studies, Chicano studies, like there's just a lot, you know, that's coming into let's win some elections, let's gain some political power, but let's also tell a story.
Right.
And have a different public account.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if people want their names used or not, so I'm not going to use names. There's a quick question in the Q&A. Do you see a correlation between this history and the political movement erasure of Black history in the classroom? So, and I actually wanted to, I'm just going to follow up with that important question about some of these curricular matters that, of course, very much part of this kind of cultural war we're in at the moment. Because in the conclusion of the book, you talk about kind of the so-called reckoning of last summer, and you list some of the things that came out of that, the corporate statements, Quaker oaths, taking a stand or whatever, high schools being renamed. And you say that these things are, as you write, insufficient substitutes for the structural transformations that Black Americans have long been calling for. So in response to the question in my critique, I'm wondering, like, how important is the classroom piece? How important are these structural transformations? What are those structural transformations? Is one of them the classroom? Like, what, how do you understand the relationship between these different kinds of transformations that we are undergoing or wish to go undergo?
Well, in some ways, in order to bring about the kind of structural transformation that are necessary, and the, frankly, the mode of governance that will be necessary, where, you know, these social problems are not responded to with policing and prisons, but are responded to with resources, responded to with job creation programs and the expansion of educational opportunities. So much of that is a hearts and minds battle where, you know, where here education is so important, right? To understand the way in which discrimination, racial oppression has shaped political and economic development in the United States. And so it's not surprising that in a moment when, you know, in the aftermath of, you know, tens of millions of people taking to the streets and what some people are saying, you know, is the largest social movement in US history, demanding racial justice, demanding social justice, making links between, you know, issues of police brutality and climate change and LGBTQ plus rights, you know, all of this has to do right with our investments, how we allocate our resources, And why we have privileged policing over meeting other basic social needs, and a definition of public safety that says that communities are can be kept safe by arresting people and putting them in prison, which, as we know now, and this is, you know, one of the things I think both of my, you know, my research really aims to show, is that, you know, this path, this punitive path, when alternatives were consistently presented has been a humongous policy failure. But it's in, you know, in reaction to the fact, for one, that systemic racism became a buzzword last summer. And these conversations about how we remember history and who gets to be remembered and who gets to be celebrated were really challenged by the protests. I mean, both, you know, in the kind of rhetoric of protest itself and the issues that were brought to the fore, but then also, right, what, you know, the literal defacing of monuments and the call to pull many of these monuments down. So there is a kind of feedback loop. You know, I think the Juneteenth, you know, the fact that Juneteenth was made a federal holiday, and many people have made this point, you know, in a moment when critical race theory is coming under attack, when, you know, in some places, if some of these bans are fully implemented, the history of slavery won't even be taught.
You can't explain Juneteenth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that what last summer demonstrated, what the election demonstrated, what even public opinion polling indicates about some of Biden's policies is that most Americans do support a different set of policies, do support the expansion of public goods, do support the pumping of new resources and investments into communities. And as last summer indicate, do support policies that are based on the notion of equality. And this is, of course, also happening in a moment of immense demographic change in the US, where, you know, most of the people under the age of 16, I think beginning last year, are not white. By 2050, white people will be the minority here. And I think that that this is where democracy is at the crossroads. Who is American democracy for? I think most people want an expansive democracy. And this is increasingly a battle to or a vision of the republic that is based on white supremacy, and to challenge that, you know, that's about education, that's about breaking down the arbitrary things that divide us that are bad for all of us, as the Caro story demonstrates.
There's another question about political violence. So the questioner writes, America has always tolerated political violence. Given that there are more guns now in the hands of private individuals, that is to say, than previously, there's a rise in tremendous spike in gun ownership, gun purchases this year. What do you see happening in the next few years? And I'm going to tack on to that, because also widely reported along with the increase in gun sales is the increase in violent crime.
Yeah, so I think, you know, part of this has to do with especially the rates of gun violence, of course, can't be separated from COVID. And again, you know, just the economic precarity that we're now in, you know, widening inequality and people feeling generally unsafe. You know, I think the persistence of gun violence, especially in low-income communities of color, is a further indication that, you know, the policy path, again, of the post-civil rights era, the kind of punitive turn in governance, has not effectively worked to keep people safe. Because one of the big questions that comes out of my research and that I pose in the book is that, and that I think we really need to reckon with, is that why in the communities that are where, you know, that are over-policed, where enforcement is targeted, communities where incarceration rates are really high, young people are more likely to die either by a police officer or more likely by each other, right? And this indicates that the definition of public safety, the idea that arresting people and incarcerating them keeps communities safe, has not worked, is not the answer. I think, you know, the promising responses to gun violence, and not just in communities of color, but across the United States, is thinking about, well, one, you know, harm reduction programs that empower community members themselves to intervene. So I'm thinking of programs like Advanced Peace and, in Northern California. It originated in Richmond. The program is expanding to New York City, where fellows, that's what they're called, who had been involved in gun violence, mentor young people. I think we need a more treatment-based approach to solving these problems, because both, you know, what we've witnessed in COVID is that, and we see this, you know, even outside, in recent years, right, that that gun violence among young Black men in particular, but suicides among young white men in particular, are particularly prevalent. And so, you know, the response, we need to think about how we can respond with treatment and with different sets of resources, and not by punishing people. Now there's this kind of arms race, I think, because of the fear and the divisions out there and the miseducation, that people think that the answer to the feelings of insecurity is to arm themselves, that having a gun makes everybody more safe. And again, you know, there is a different vision that we can realize of what safety can and should be.
One of the reasons people should buy and read this book and Professor Hinton's first book is just been illustrated for us, which is how clearly you can speak about the patterns of the past that have got us here, but how willing you are to think about solutions, which is not the case with most historians. And it's so essential in this topic. Like, I think your work more than anyone else's does the really crucial, hard work of establishing empirically what a massive policy failure this has been, that everything that it was supposedly attempting to do, it has failed to do, and it has created 1,000 other kinds of problems that even, you know, couldn't have been anticipated by nefarious policymakers, no less those who were well-intentioned. But thinking about those solutions is so important. Sorry,
go ahead. Can I just jump in there real quick?
Yeah.
Just say that, like, you know, I don't, it's not, the solutions were there. I mean, that's one of the things that the archives show. You know, yeah. I didn't think of all these solutions on my own. I think I've compiled the evidence that helps make the arguments that other people made at the time that weren't realized. And I'm thinking especially of the Kerner Commission, who, you know, Johnson calls, as I'm sure many people know, during the rebellion in Detroit in 67, and charges them with studying the causes of the so-called riots in American cities during his presidency and suggesting solutions. And the Kerner Commission said, if we're really serious about stopping this violence, we have to go beyond the war on poverty. We need a massive investment of resources into these communities. We have to think beyond the police. I mean, the Kerner Commission had a number of recommendations for police reform, but their actual program was much more ambitious in saying, we need to pump resources. We need essentially a Marshall Plan for American cities. And we see similar recommendations time and time again. I mean, one of the, you know, other, I think, ones for me in the book that was really important was a proposal put forth by Crips and Bloods gang sets in Watts during the LA Rebellion of 1992, saying, you know, invest different set, you know, as you're rebuilding Los Angeles, we will stop gang violence and invest different sets of resources so that we no longer have to engage in informal economies and we can be empowered as a community. I mean, these solutions and structural analysis is presented time and time again, and yet it's never realized. And so, you know, you have to wonder what the U.S. would look like today if the Kerner Commission's recommendations, if the Johnson administration would have had a very different reaction to the Kerner Commission report, instead of not ever commenting on it and thinking it was too radical, say, you know what? Yeah, that's what I want my legacy to be. We're going to, instead of making a job creation program for police officers with the war on crime, we're going to make a job creation program for low-income Americans. We're going to take the war on poverty a step further, and that never happened. And here we are.
One of the members of the audience asks, if the archives make clear that the rebellions peaked well after April of 1968, how do you think the narrative was constructed that it peaked with King's assassination and then calmed down? Are there specific groups that had an interest in deliberately constructing that narrative? Did academic historians take it up, or did they have a key role in propagating it? And I guess I would ask you there too, What about the burying of the Kerner Commission report in that moment, in that same moment in 68?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of it has to do with how, with national coverage. I mean, that's why this Lemberg archive is such a gem, because it's these tiny local newspaper clippings that that historians don't pay as much attention to. And it also speaks to the kind of success of the weaponizing of local police departments, where, you know, from the late 60s to the early 70s, the National Guard didn't have to be called. You didn't have to call, you know, for backup as much from state and county governments, because local police departments were equipped with armored trucks and battering rams, and some places helicopters and things that you wouldn't need to mobilize, again, the National Guard or federal troops for. And with that calling of the National Guard, with that big mobilization of force comes news coverage. So I think a lot of it is the result of news coverage, and the fact that historians tend to, you know, follow kind of national trends as they begin to construct and craft stories. And so it's harder to kind of craft a narrative of this post 68 moment as being one of a kind of continuation of this collective political violence. The narrative that gets crafted, we talk about this too, is really the image of the Black sniper that emerges very much in a Vietnam War context, but that begins to kind of take hold as a way to explain the kind of the drama and violence of rebellion really beginning in Newark and Detroit. And, you know, this image of the Black sniper, you know, waiting in the wings on a rooftop, ready to shoot and kill a police officer, becomes the kind of the narrative of rebellion. It's in part, again, why the narrative about Cairo was that the good white citizens of the city were being attacked. And it leads again to it reinforces the logic of policing as a solution and increasing ideas about, or ideas that are beginning to steer domestic policy away from war on poverty programs about criminality, especially in low-income communities of color. So yeah, I mean, a lot of it just has to do, I don't know if it's as much of a conscious thing as it is the difficulty of gathering sources, and the fact that that reporters, historians tend to focus on the big national story rather than, you know, what's going on in Waterloo, mm-hmm. Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you one more question, which is a selfish question of me to ask, because I'm trying to write a new chapter to my history of the United States, because it ended in 2016 and I have to end it in 2020. And I've been really, I will say, you know, knocked back on my heels at thinking of just watching the re-narration of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, right? So seemed like on the day, everybody understood what was going on. It was an armed insurrection of white supremacists. And now, you know, we're not having a commission to investigate it because it was just normal tourist activity. So I guess I'm wondering, this is the kind of question I will say as this right often drives me a little batty, but like, what, if you think about, say, that, you know, the Trayvon Martin to George Floyd, 7-8 years down to now, what do you think will be the right way for historians to narrate that, and therefore for the public to have an understanding of it? And what do you see emerging as a competing narrative that you find very dangerous?
Well, I think the competing narrative, that's the easier one. That's the easier one. The competing narrative, and I think we're already beginning to see it, is the usual narrative, right? I mean, we're beginning to hear new talk about crime again. And I think this is, again, this follows this larger pattern. In a moment when it seemed like we were taking, you know, states were beginning to decarcerate, there's still a lot of problems with that process, but we're beginning to have these new conversations about criminal, the reform of the criminal legal system, that now there's a new emphasis on crime, there's a new emphasis on violence. And so that to me is dangerous. And I think it's very much a part of these culture wars and this campaign and attack against critical race theory. I think we'll remember. I think that, you know, the Trayvon to George Floyd to January 6th is a stark reminder of just how far we still have to go. And has fully, I mean, I think especially with the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, revealed the kind of, you know, even beyond the kind of the mobilization of white supremacy that we saw during the Trump administration, but just the lengths that these competing visions of what America is are, yeah, I mean how they continue to structure political activity, how they can continue to structure debates, and just how divided we are.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. There were some great questions in the Q&A that we didn't get to. Sorry for those of you who raised questions. I think you'll find some answers in Professor Hinton's most recent book. And I want to encourage you all to show up again at the Free Library for its future slate of events. You can probably find more information about that in the chat and on the website. And I know we all hope to be together in Philadelphia or some other city sometime soon. Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time, and congratulations again on this vitally important and searing work.
Thank you so much, everyone. Jill, for you taking the time and for your incredibly thoughtful questions. It really means a lot to me.
All right. Good night, all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.